Themes of my lectures so far are outlined here for those of you who either have missed some or been unable to come to number four. And as you see, it takes the form of what we call a jigsaw puzzle, bits fitted together. So through these lectures, I've been trying to fit together a picture of modernity and the modern world. I defined in the first question the nature of modernity as the fact that human beings have four main spheres of interest. They're the economy, the politics, religion and ideology, and society or family. And in most societies, historically, these have all been within one group, the family, like that. That's tribal societies. Modernity consists of you as individuals, this is one human being, who is the only connecting point between politics, economic, society, and religion. These are autonomous, separated spheres. In theory, of course, in practice, they tend to try and join together in what we call corruption or influence or whatever. But in theory, we try to keep these apart. And this is really what the modern world consists of, that separation, which, as I've argued in previous talks, seems to have originated in England and seems to have originated up to 1,000 years ago. The question in my first lecture was, why did England become an industrial civilization 50 years before anywhere else? And I related that to its warfare, fighting all the time but on other people's land, and the huge empire it developed to push its ideas out. It had the first agricultural revolution and the first industrial revolution in the world of modern kind in the 18th century, but going right back for another 500 years, and it was the first capitalist nation. Capitalism being the separation of the economy and society, according to Max Weber. So it was the first to separate out those two. Its material life, that is, physical things like housing and food and drink and so on, was very rich from very early on. They lived well, and that is a sign of modernity. And its population was controlled by not having too many children, rather than by death. It had a very successful scientific revolution, Robert Boyle, Newton, and so on, and was very keen to apply science to practical problems, and the Industrial Revolution was related, obviously, to the Scientific Revolution. Behind all this lay a very strange class system whereby you weren't born with a position. There were no legal differences between you and anyone else. And, as I mentioned, there were many, many ladders. You could climb up these ladders, mainly through making money, and reach right the top within your lifetime, or educate your children to reach the top. So a strange, modern, open class system, which de Tocqueville talked about. Class was really a complex game. You played against other people, and you won a bit, and then you went up a bit, and you won again, you went up a bit. So games of various kinds, competitive games, have been very important in English culture for hundreds of years, and now have been exported in the world. Religions like football and cricket came from England. This open system was related to a kinship structure whereby the family was very weak and it pushed its children out when they were very young, 7 or 8. Being pushed out, they couldn't depend on their wider family, their cousins and aunts and uncles, for support and so on. So friendship between equals developed very, very fast and powerfully in England. And this friendship was often related to one of the important features, civil society, groups of people who played together, worked together, enjoyed life together, and formed many of the great organizations which lie between the state and the citizen. That civil society protected England against the abuse of power. It led to the first modern democracy in the world, which has been exported from England through America to the rest of the world, to a rather light bureaucratic system where people voluntarily exercise power because you had a large middle class. And all this and the maintenance of the tension and the separation of these things occurred through the legal system, which was very, very sophisticated and very developed early on. So that's where we've got to with all the parts, and I've only got four more parts to add here, and I'll deal with two of them now, because if you look at this, all of this, apart from culture of games, there's very little here about emotions, about feeling, about ideas, some in science, but the whole intellectual, emotional side of life so far I haven't dealt with, and yet it's terribly important. So I'll start with education and language. Because if you want to know what creates a modern person, what generates the attitudes of modernity towards profit and class and all those things, you have to look at the educational system, what people do at school and how the schools are organized. English schools for thousand years or so have been very odd compared to all schools in all other societies. This is because they educated people in a much broader sense than just formal schooling, that is just teaching how to read and write and do sums and things like that. Education in England was the main form of social mobility. You wanted your children to move up into the middle and upper classes, they had to go through the right education, rather like the Confucian system in China. So education was the pivot of this system because of the class system. And education, above all, created capitalism because it split, I talked about this a bit before, it split the economy from the society. It took people out of their families, their social group, and threw them out into the wider society, away from their family, and onto the economic market, and also into local politics, as it were. So it pushed people out into a wider world. And it taught them to be individuals, to be fully separate with their own rights, their human rights, their dignities, their responsibilities towards each other. And these rights and responsibilities and the networks you formed at school were a matter of the individual's decision. Your religious views, your political views, your economic effectiveness were not shaped by your parents, as they are in all other societies. Your family would teach you morality, they would teach you what to think about political matters and other matters. But in England, you were taught these things by friends, employers, and teachers. You learned to be alone, to draw on your own resources, to be independent and tough, the what I call the Robinson Crusoe tradition, based on Daniel Defoe's novel, Robinson Crusoe. In particular, the system of grammar and public schools, a grammar school was the term for a school that was not very expensive, and you would find them in many English towns for the last 400 or 500 years. But they were very good teaching schools, and they were slightly below the level, or often the same level, as the public schools. A public school, it's difficult to explain to people that by public school you don't mean a public school in England. In fact, whenever you use the word public in England, you don't mean public in the sense of free and open to everyone. A public school is very expensive to go to, particularly nowadays. But if you had the money, you sent your children to one of these schools which teaches children from the age of about 13 to 18. And then you go on to university. These schools, both the grammar schools and the public schools, and below them what we call the preparatory schools between 8 and 13, were odd in various ways. One was that they actually were there to teach you to think. And what we mean by teaching you to think in England is not to go into school and to recite the classics, Confucius or Mencius or whatever, and learn it off by heart, or to recite the Quran or the holy sutras of the Buddhist texts. That we don't think is teaching you to think at all. It's teaching you to remember. But for us, in order to teach you to think, memory is only a very small part of it. The more important part is to teach you to argue, to disagree, to try out new ideas, to invent new solutions, and to try and persuade other people of your ideas. Most educational systems, I should think 9 out of 10 in the world, are very focused, very narrow. The idea of education is really to teach you to carry on the traditions of the past, to remember to read the classics, to learn them, to have them inside you, and then you pass them on. They're like libraries. You turn people into small libraries of great books. This was not the English tradition of schools. You were meant to disagree. You were meant to challenge. You were meant to say, Confucius says this, that's rubbish, I don't agree. Or the Bible says this, I interpret this in way, this way, you interpret it in that way. To argue. And so you have a confrontational model of education, which is similar to our games. In other words, education is a game. Your teacher gives you an idea, or you send an idea to your teacher, and you get it back, back and forth, back and forth. And this is how we teach in Cambridge, and this is how I was taught at my boarding schools. And you learn all this from strangers, not from your parents. Of course, if you're learning it from your parents, it may be very difficult to disagree with them or challenge them, because they are your parents as well. And so you can see how a Confucian education system, which stresses the power of parents over their children, fits with the family system. In our system, the people you are arguing with are not relatives of yours. And if, obviously you show some respect, but if you can show that you understand something better or you make a very good point, that is thought to be a good thing. So, in this way, they developed this system of education where, as I think I mentioned, over 180 years ago, there was 20,000, and this is a small island, 20,000 what we call preparatory schools, that is schools for people when they're just 8, 9, 10, 11, that sort of age, and a great number of public schools, famous ones like Eton, Winchester, Rugby, Westminster, Charterhouse and others. The second oddity was not only that you were taught how to think, how to argue, how to disagree, how to challenge, the Socratic method, as it's sometimes called, after Socrates, where he would get you to put arguments against things and for things, or what was sometimes called disputations, disputing things. But the second odd feature was that the school, as I briefly mentioned, was not really about, mainly about teaching formal things in the classroom. That was very important as well. But above all, it was about character. And what we meant by character was the ability in non-family relations the ability to move out into society, to move out into a job, to move out into the economy, to move out into a profession like being a religious teacher or a lawyer or anything, and be successful there. It wasn't a matter of the home teaching you all the skills and also how you should behave, ethics and morality and character. You were sent away from home, either as an apprentice or a servant, or later higher up as someone going to university or and school. And there you were shaped. You were literally sometimes and mentally beaten into a new shape. You were taken from this home setting and put out as a free person, and you were beaten as you beat in many kinds of craft activity, if you're making gold objects or Japanese swords. You beat and beat and beat and beat them until they're very, very sharp. That's what you did with people. You beat them into sharpness. And sometimes you literally beat them. In my school, until I left, though it's stopped now, you were beaten if you misbehaved with a cane. This was meant to, all of this education away from home was meant to make you into a tough, supposedly self-confident and resourceful adult, so that you would have the skills which would lead you into being successful at the top, because these public schools anyway were for the elite and the grammar schools and universities, the top of wherever you were going to end up. You might start in the Navy as a midshipman and end up as an admiral. You might start up as a small trader in India and end up as a high official of the East India Company. You might start as an ordinary, humble lawyer and end up as the Lord Chief Chancellor, the Lord Chief Justice of England. And in the process of moving up these ladders, the skills you had learned at school were not just how to think quickly and argue and discuss, but also to work with people. So it wasn't sheer individualism and selfishness you were being taught. You were being taught how to work with people. I talked earlier about this in relation to games. You were taught how to both be individualistic in your games playing and also to collaborate, cooperate with people. Because that's what you would be doing. You'd be joining organizations which would require not just individual brilliance, but the ability to lead other people, to work with other people, to persuade other people. Now, this system was the perfect background. It developed in England from about 1400 years ago, the first public schools. But by the 16th century, i.e. 500 years ago, it was very fully formed all over England. We had a lot of these kinds of schools. And that was the time when England started its imperial expansion. And this education system was a perfect underpinning, a perfect training ground for holding together the largest empire the world has ever known. Because for such an empire to be held together by just a very, very few people from this small country, you needed an administrative system based on great self-confidence, great ability to work with other people, and a great amount of mutual trust between the rulers who are ruling it. So the ruling gentry, and this also applied to the home area, because England was run, as I mentioned, largely by the upper middle class gentlemen who'd been to universities and so on. And they had learnt the ethics of ruling and the ethics of education through going to similar schools. One had gone to this school, another had gone to that school. And the networks of contacts at these schools, most famously at Eton Public School, Cambridge, the Inns of Court. So we keep thinking that maybe this is an old-fashioned model and that it's all disappeared. If you look at the English cabinet, the people who rule England now, most of them are from this school, Eton. Our prime ministers from there, our chancellors from Eton, and Nick Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister, is from another famous public school. So our system hasn't really changed, even though we are more egalitarian than we were. Now, these schools were particularly important because in all other empires, if you're trying to hold together this large empire, what the other imperial powers did, and I mentioned this briefly in another lecture, is to send their missionaries and their imperial servants out to Latin America or Indochina or wherever it was, if they were French, Portuguese, Spanish and so on. They would then settle there, send their children to the local mission school, and after two or three generations they would have put down roots in the colonies. The English model was strange and different because we already had this system of our children through these schools and then them going back to wherever they were in Britain, well established. What happened when the empire grew in Jamaica and then later in India and elsewhere was that in the parts of the empire which were not white settler ones, this didn't apply in North America and it didn't apply so much in Canada and Australia, but in West Indies, in Africa, in Burma and in India, you had a system of cyclical change, so that people, just to take my example, which I have mentioned in the past, my parents go out to India, my grandparents go out to India, my great-grandparents go out to various places, and as soon as they have their children, they send them home to England, and they go to these kinds of schools. So I went through the same process, and I was just preparing to do the same thing, which had been going on for 300, 400, 500 years in England, and then the British Empire ended. So instead I became a historian and anthropologist and ended up coming to China. It's repeated itself in a different way. And what this imperial, this educational system did was the same thing as it did for our local situation, where our members of our ruling class know each other, at least they know each other in the sense that they know, they understand each other, they went to similar kinds of schools and similar experiences. So likewise, when someone sent a message from North India to South India, or from South India to China or Singapore, they understood each other, they could trust each other, they had an imagined link with them in a very strong way because they'd been through the same childhood experiences. Now, another part of education which is of interest is how it affects the chances of being modern in the sense of having an efficient and modern technology and industrial process. Here, at one level, you can say that literacy, that is the ability to read and write, doesn't seem to be an absolutely central feature of modernization in the sense of industrialization. There have been a number of very literate societies, like Japan or Scotland, which didn't become industrial in the first wave. And England wasn't a particularly literate society. The levels of ability to read and write weren't particularly high. But I think if you take education in a wider sense, not just in the formal sense of how well you can read or write, then the system of education I've described was absolutely essential to create a capitalist society. It broke the link with the family, put you out in the marketplace, and it taught you certain skills of independent thinking, a desire to succeed, an ability to trust people, to work with other people, which certainly in the 18th century Industrial Revolution can be seen again and again to be important. And in one other way, also, it was it's difficult just to take literacy rates, because if you look at the class or the distribution of wealth, which I mentioned to you, in most societies it's like this. The very rich, and then most of the population down here, or even this lot down here, are peasants. They are not educated at all. They can't read or write. This is an oral culture, which is often 90% of the population down here. So I mentioned the English social structure was perhaps quite as dramatic as that, but more like a bell, like this. So this is the working class down here, and this is the middle class, certainly the rich middle class and the lower middle class. All these ones up here in England had some ability in reading and writing. So reading and writing was distributed much more widely. One of the characteristics of many peasant societies and traditional societies like China is that you have a huge gap. You have a small group of educated people who came through Confucian education up and up and up, and then a vast sea of people who don't have any education at all. If you've gone around Europe 200 years ago, you would have found this. You would have found whole villages and regions of Italy, Spain, France, and so on, where no one in the villages could read or use any of the complex tools of modern education. It was restricted to the upper middle class and the middle class in the towns. In England, reading and writing, some skill in this, spread downwards. And that meant that as you had industrial and economic progress, you had masses and masses of people in this area who could contribute. And even these people down here had some skill. And even these people down here could appreciate many of the skills above. So if you look at the origins of many of our inventors and scientists and thinkers and poets and so on in English history, they come from all these levels. Newton, for example, just went to a grammar school in Lincolnshire. So you get ordinary people moving up through the system if they have talent. And that's rather unusual. Of course, you do get it in the Confucian system, which is one of the great examples of using education as a form of mobility. But only a very few, it takers off, and only a very few get up to the highest level. And, as I say, they're getting a kind of education which is different. So it's a peculiar educational system that England has, and it's one that has been spread. It was spread to India, it was obviously spread to America, the American schools, the American universities. The whole educational system there was derived from these English patterns. And so gradually it spread all over the world, and I suspect, and it would be interesting to talk to you, that many of the fundamentals of education in your country are now being influenced by models which come from this historical accident of a schooling system. The very fact that you have schools, that you send lots of people to schools, is a byproduct of this, and that they're not learning just repetitively. Though this is something, a lesson which might be drawn, that when you're investigating the effects of educational systems, you need to look not just whether people are going into classrooms, but what they're learning both in the classrooms and particularly outside the classrooms. One of the things my wife and I have noticed traveling in many parts of the world is that it's very easy to adopt the idea of a school. Everyone's wearing school uniforms and they're reading from books and so on. But they're not challenging the teacher, and they're learning facts all the time. And they're not disputing and arguing. And that is missing a dimension, because it needs to you to be very conservative in your thought. You just repeat what you have already learned from the ancestors. You don't think of new things. The English educational system is to try and make it possible to, for you to find a new way around problems, whether it's a scientific problem or an economic problem. So constant invention, not to take past knowledge as fixed. And this obviously links up with science more generally. It's an open world. I was taught from the moment I went to school that this was just an opinion. It might not be right. Did I think it was wrong or right? And from my class books and so on, I could see that if I disagreed with something or put a counter-argument, my teachers were very pleased. They didn't want me to just repeat everything. This is a difference which you even find within the British educational system. The Scottish educational system was very, very good, but it was also slightly towards the end. It was a very religious educational system originally, based on Calvinism. And I remember some students coming to my lectures in Cambridge, and I'd been giving my usual lecture saying, there are some arguments for this, there are some arguments for that. You will have to decide, you know, which is a better theory or argument. And a student, a Scottish student, came up afterwards and said to me, well, you said all that, but which is right? I want you to tell me. It's not enough just to say this on one hand and this. Our Scottish teachers used to say, well, this is the right one because of this, and that's the wrong one. But I said, no, in England, you put these. And it flows out into our politics and everything. If you see a debate between the House of Commons where they're arguing about politics, they're constantly challenging each other. Our law is like that. Our science is like that. And it starts in the age of 2, 3, 4, when you first go to school, you're being encouraged to do this. Okay, so I will give you a break there. I hope it doesn't sound too in fact, I realized that I'm running out of time. I thought this is part of the last lecture, so I'll just summarize this and then we'll move on to the second half, which is more important. The main points I want to make in relation to language is that English is a very egalitarian language. It fits with this egalitarian social structure. There is no gender difference in English. French, you have male and female nouns and so on and so on. In English, you don't have male and female nouns. And there is very little difference in how you address men and women. Furthermore, it isn't a class language, which is very unusual. I gather from recent discussion that in China, you had a special language for the upper class, top class, which wasn't really understood by ordinary people. We have nothing of that in England. This is why one interesting fact about it is literature, which was appreciated by almost everyone, even if you couldn't read or write. The English Bible, which was translated into English, King James Bible, was enjoyed by everyone in England, really. Likewise, Shakespeare and poetry and so on was very widespread. So it's a flat, equal sort of language which goes with its social structure, and it spreads over the whole of England. England had one common language by the late Anglo-Saxon period. For a period it introduced French, but then that disappeared. And the final point about language I'd like to just very quickly, is that it's a language which is very suitable for literature. It has, the English are not particularly good at many of the arts, like music and so on, but they have arguably the greatest literature in world history, and this is because it seems to be a very tough, complex, but flexible sort of language, which, partly because of its intrinsic quality, partly because of the British Empire, is now the world language in many, many fields, as you know. And it's a language which is delightful to use. I was taught from very early on the tricks of language, because language is a class marker. Even though it's equal, your accent and the way you use language immediately places you in our class system. And one of its most important features, which I keep finding I was being taught explicitly at school, is humour. The English spend much of their time laughing, joking, making not very good jokes sometimes, but joking all the time. I noticed this once I became aware of it recently. I just watched my interaction with my children, my grandchildren, my friends. We're constantly making jokes. And English is a very good language for joking. And it's also got a particular form of humour, which is slightly painful, but very powerful, which we call irony. How many of you have heard of irony? Some of you heard of irony? Yeah. It means saying the opposite of what you mean. You say, "Oh, you're wearing a wonderful hat today." And that means you think they're wearing a terrible hat. Or, explicitly, you use it with another person about something else. You all know that you're referring to something else. So you can, for instance, say about a politician, you know, we really think this politician, you know, there's never been anyone like him since Oliver Cromwell or something. And you just say it in a way and the other person picks up the undertone of it. And so you share this criticism, this confrontation of the world, through saying the opposite of what you mean. And it's universal. The greatest ironists and satirists in linguistic terms, many of them were English: Swift, Pope, Oscar Wilde, and so on. Shakespeare as well, obviously. And it reflects a world where there's a great deal of shared experience. Our humour systems go right across our social structure. So you can tell a joke in almost any situation in England with any group of people, and usually they'll really enjoy it. I noticed this recently. My daughter and son-in-law often go to hear stand-up comedians, which is a great fashion now in England, where someone just stands up and makes jokes for a while. And this is very popular, live humour. And I asked them what sort of people were there, and they said everyone. I mean, you know, some upper middle class, working class, everyone enjoys this kind of similar humour, which is another sign of equality in the system.